Thank you very much. Whenever speaking in YU or in Washington Heights in general, the very first thing I have to say is that although I had the schus of knowing Rav Shimon Rom, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, we are not related, to my chagrin. Both of us changed the name. He was Rav Shimon of Issachar, we were Romanovsky. He was from Lita, we're from the Ukraine. So just to get that off the table before we start, but an Adam Gadol Me'od, and certainly it's kedai to mention his name, you know, as we begin the shiur today. The topic I entitled "The Three Oaths: A Policy for the Modern State of Israel?" Question mark. That's what we're going to try to explore a little bit today. As we know, the three oaths, which we'll see the Gemara about in just a moment, played and continue to play a very central role in the ongoing debate within the Orthodox community going back 150 plus years about the acceptability of the modern religious Zionist movement, the resettlement, the creation of the State of Israel. 2017-2018, Tovshin Ayin Ches actually is a very good year to discuss all of these issues because it's a very historic year in terms of the State of Israel. We marked 100 years since the Balfour Declaration back in November, 70 years since the UN officially gave its approval to the partition plan. This coming spring will mark 70 years since the Declaration of Independence of Israel. So to go back and analyze one of the Talmudic sources, which was really at the center of the debate over the whole issue of creating a modern state of Israel, would seem to be appropriate. What are the three oaths? So if you take a look at the first page in the handout, it's a very famous Gemara in Ksubis, Daf Kuf Yud Aleph, Amid Aleph, where the Gemara there points to the fact that if we look in Shir HaShirim, we find three times where the Pasuk says, Hishbati eschem benos Yerushalayim, I've made you swear, O daughters of Jerusalem, im to'iru v'im to'oru es ha'ahava ad shetechpots. You should not awaken, you should not arouse the love until the time of desire. Something which is a little bit vague. So explains the Gemara, okay, if I bracketed it, it's about eight lines from the top of the page, says the Gemara that the three times in Shir HaShirim where it speaks of Hishbati Eschem, I have made you swear, the reference is to the Ribbono Shel Olam imposing three different oaths. Two of the oaths, as we'll see, are incumbent upon the Jewish people. The third oath is incumbent upon the nations of the world at large. And explains the Gemara, Gimo Shvuos Halalu Lama, what is the nature of these three oaths? Achas Shaloyalu Yisrael Bechoma, the first oath is to tell the Jewish people, to make the Jewish people swear that they should not go up to Eretz Yisrael, Kachoma, like a wall, which would seem to imply en masse, in other words, the Jewish people as a group should not all decide that they're going to leave the Golos and go up to Eretz Yisrael. V'achas shehishbiya HaKadosh Baruch Hu es Yisrael shelo yimredu ba'umos ha'olam. The second oath, the Ribbono Shel Olam made the Jewish people swear that they should not rebel against the nations of the world. Again, both of these oaths are administered to the Jewish people during the course of our galus, during the course of our exile. And finally, the third oath, V'achas shehishbiya HaKadosh Baruch Hu es ha'ovdei kochavim shlo yishtabdu bohem b'Yisrael yoser midai. The third oath was administered by the Ribbono Shel Olam to the nations of the world that they should not subjugate the Jewish people excessively while the Jewish people are in galus. If you continue past the brackets, the Gemara goes on to bring an alternative, a twist on the three oaths, where the Gemara points out that although the term Hishbati Eschem, I've made you swear, is used three times in Shir HaShirim, the continuation of those psukim indicate that that for each time that it says Hishbati Eschem, there are actually two oaths. Im to'iru v'im to'oru. You should not arouse, you should not awaken the love. So in other words, it's a sum total of six oaths. So the Gemara then goes on to say, again, one line after the brackets, Sheishvuos halalu lama. What's the nature of these six oaths? Tlosa Hani de Amran, three of the oaths we just delineated. Enoch Shlo Yigalu Esakets, the other three oaths refer to the fact that the Jewish people should not reveal when Moshiach is ultimately going to come. V'shelo yirachaku esakeitz, the Girsa of our Gemara says that the Jewish people are sworn not to push off the ultimate redemption. And Rashi brings an, how would that be? That would be through our sins. In other words, if we're sinful, we're going to push off the ultimate redemption. Rashi brings an alternative reading, shelo yidachaku esakeitz, we should not force the coming of Moshiach prematurely. And finally, shelo yigalu hasod la'ovdei kachovim, that the Jewish people, while in Galus, should not reveal the secret to the idolaters, to the nations of the world. Again, what's the secret? I guess I can't really tell you. It's a secret, right? But what's the secret? Rashi has two interpretations. Either the sod ha'ibur, the complexities involved with calculating the Jewish calendar, or alternatively, Sisrei Torah, the secrets of Torah itself, are not supposed to be revealed to the nations of the world. In other words, there's certain parts of Torah that are supposed to be the exclusive province of the Jewish people and not revealed to the world. In any case, three oaths, perhaps six oaths, all of which address the Jewish position in exile. That the Jews in exile, the Jews in Galus, it seems, are not supposed to act in a way which is overly aggressive, not going up as a group to Eretz Yisrael, not rebelling against the nations of the world, not trying to force an end to the Galus. When the question of establishing a state of Israel began in the 1800s, those Rabbanim who were opposed to the whole enterprise of Zionism would point to this text as being a primary text against that whole endeavor. What's the whole idea of going up to Eretz Yisrael, establishing a state with or without the consent of the nations of the world, being ole bachoma, going up en masse? All of the activities that were being advocated for by the early Zionist movement seem to be in contradiction to this Gemara. We know that the individual, the Gadol B'Yisrael, who's most associated with this Gemara as being the primary source text against the idea of Zionism is the Satma Rav, right, Rav Yoel Teitelbaum. And in his writings, Maimar al Agula ve'al Tmura, Maimar Shalosh Shvuos, the Satmar Rav points to this Gemara as being, again, the main text, one of the main texts against the whole idea of establishing a state of Israel. We should point out that although the Satmar Rav is probably the most associated with this particular position, particularly because he was more recent, and he and his followers continued to be very vehement about this position, there were many Gedolim going back to the 19th century who took a similar position, some of whom we might be surprised by. I mean, to take one example of someone whose worldview in many ways was very different than Satmar, but on this issue converged with Satmar, one looks at the writings of Shamshon Raphael Hirsch. And Rav Hirsch is at South, we're in Washington Heights, so we have to mention Rav Hirsch. Rav Hirsch, in his Chorev, his classic statement of Jewish thought and Jewish practice, quotes this statement in the Gemara in Ksubas, and says, we see from here that there's a mandate that comes from the Gemara and ultimately from Shir HaShirim not to end the Galus prematurely. In other words, Rav Hirsch understood this Gemara much the same way that Satmar would understand the Gemara later. There is an imperative to keep the Galus intact. There is an imperative to not end the Galus prematurely before the coming of Moshiach. And all of that is wrapped up with this Gemara. What did those, and what do those who were advocates of Zionism before the State of Israel and who support the existence of the State of Israel today, what does the other side do with this Gemara, with the Shalosh Shvuos? So the simplest answer may simply be that this is Agadata. And who's to say that this necessarily has any halachic bearing? We know there are many statements in the Gemara that are statements of agadata, of a non-halachic nature. They don't necessarily influence what we're supposed to do in practical halacha, halacha l'maisa. So if one looks in the codes of Jewish law, one looks in the Rif, one looks in the Rambam, one looks in the Torah, one looks in the Shulchan Aruch, there is no mention of these shalosh shvuos in any way. And, you know, that may, the simplest way to be a proponent of Zionism in the State of Israel in light of this Gemara in Ksubis may simply to be this, to say that this is not normative. This is not something which, you know, is going to influence us in a practical halachic sense. Beyond that, particularly as events in the early 20th century seemed to move in the direction of the establishment of the State of Israel, numerous gedolim of the early 20th century offered alternative ways of understanding the Gemara, not saying that it was simply an agadata and therefore did not have halachic import, but accepting on a fundamental level the Gemara of the Shalosh Shvuos, of the three oaths, but pointing out that for one reason or another, it would not apply to the creation of a modern-day state of Israel. If you turn over the sheet to the second page, this is a citation in English from the book Torat Eretz Yisrael, which is a compendium of the thought of Rav Yehuda Cook, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, put together by Rabbi David Samson. So here the author quotes a rather famous letter for Meir Simcha Cohen of Dvinsk, known for his Svarim Or Sameach and Meshech Chochma. And the letter was written, if you look down in the second paragraph, after the Balfour Declaration, again, exactly 100 years ago. The letters of the Mizrahi movement in Dvinsk asked him, Rav Meir Simcha, for a letter of support for the Keren HaYesod Fund for Israel. The rabbi immediately sat down and wrote a special letter of support for the Zionist establishment. Among his many subsequent letters is the following. This is quoted in the Hebrew in a book by Rav Menachem Mendel Kasher, Hatkufa HaGedola, where he assembles, Rav Kasher Zatzal, assembles many, many sources in support not only of the State of Israel, but the whole, you know, speaking about the whole Tkufa, the whole era, which has been ushered into to Jewish history by virtue of the creation of the State of Israel. So Rav Meir Simcha wrote this letter in 1920. In the Balfour Declaration, which again we just commemorated a few months ago, the centennial, the Balfour Declaration was an important document in the history of the creation of the State of Israel, but in real terms, when it was issued in 1917, it did not really have an immediate effect, because at that time it was all theoretical. World War I had not yet ended, and the Balfour Declaration basically stated, Arthur Balfour stated, that if Palestine ends up in British hands after the dust settles following World War I, we would be interested in creating a homeland for the Jewish people in Palestine. But in 1917, it was not yet clear that Palestine would actually end up in British hands. Palestine, of course, was under the control of the Ottoman Turks up until World War I. It was clear at that point that the Ottoman Turks were losing World War I and that their empire would be divvied up among the Allied armies who had been victorious, were going to be victorious in World War I, but it wasn't yet quite clear that Palestine, that Eretz Yisrael, would end up with under the mandate of the British Empire. That was settled about three years later in 1920, when the victorious powers who had won in World War I got together in Italy, in San Remo, and formally divvied up the spoils of the those who had lost World War I. And it was only in San Remo that the British Empire officially came under control of Eretz Yisrael, what was then called Palestine. After the San Remo conference, so this is 1920, Rav Meir Simcha writes the following letter. In this century, the rays of light shine forth with a great awakening through the channels of the great men of action such as Montefiore and like him. And from the rabbis, Reb Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer, Reb Eliyahu Guttmacher, two of the rabbanim who were supportive of the early Zionist movement, parenthetically, for those who know the geography of modern-day Eretz Yisrael a little bit, there are two yeshuvim up in the Galil, which are named for these two great rabbanim, Tirat Tzvi, from which a lot of the meat comes, you know, is named for Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer, and Stei Eliyahu, also in the Galil, is named for Eliyahu Guttmacher. So they decided to build and develop Jerusalem to remove its desolation, almost to the extent which the enthusiasts have widened the cause. Many rabbis stood in opposition, even many rabbis who praised the matter, i.e. Zionism, in their hearts, put their hands on their mouths in fear of the enthusiast's zeal. Right? There were many rabbanim who were nervous about supporting the early Zionist movement, and in fear of the three oaths which Hashem made the daughter of Jerusalem swear. There were many rabbanim who, because of the Gemara in Ksubis about the Gimel Shvuas, the three oaths, were reluctant to come out and support the early Zionist movement. Now, however, divine providence has brought together the League of Intelligent Nations in San Remo, and a dictate was established that the land of Israel should be for the Jewish people. Since the fear of the oath has been removed with the permission of the nations, the mitzvah of settling the land of Israel arises, a mitzvah equal to all of the other precepts in the Torah, and this mitzvah returns to its place. The way Rav Meir Simcha is typically understood as expressing himself in this letter is in the following fashion. It's true that there's a Gemara of the Gimel Shvuos, of the three oaths, which HaKadosh Baruch Hu imposed upon the Jewish people as well as to an extent upon the nations of the world. And fundamentally speaking, we shouldn't be able to go up en masse to Eretz Yisrael and to establish ourselves as a state there. However, now that the Balfour Declaration and the San Remo Conference have established that the world at large gives us permission to establish a state in Eretz Yisrael, now the three Shvuos have fallen away, the three oaths no longer apply, and we can move ahead to establish a state. Typically speaking, Rav Meir Simcha's position is understood as essentially negating the impact of the Shalosh Shvuos once the League of Nations gave its go-ahead, its green light, for the establishment of the State of Israel. From this perspective, the Balfour Declaration, the San Remo Conference, and ultimately the UN vote for partition in November 1947 all have halachic import, because not only do they pave the way practically for the establishment of the State of Israel, because they show the consent of the nations of the world, that now removes any halachic impediment to establishing a State of Israel once they've given the green light. We'll see that I think that's not necessarily the only way to read Rav Meir Simcha. Again, there's a subtlety here, which I think we have to pick up on, which is a little bit absent in the way I just presented it. Rav Meir Simcha does not say that the three oaths are nullified. He says the fear of the oaths has been removed, which makes it sound like the oaths, to an extent, are still theoretically in place. It's just that we need no longer fear them anymore. Right now that sounds a little bit like splitting hairs, but we'll come back and I think we'll see that way of presenting it is significant. The truth is, what Rav Meir Simcha says, namely, that the consent of the nations of the world can either nullify or at least blunt the impact of the Shalosh Shvuos, on a certain level is really just Rashi, back on Gemara itself. If you turn back to that Gemara in Ksubas, so the first of the three Shvuos is described as Shelo Yalu Yisrael Bachoma. The Jewish people should not go up like a wall to Eretz Yisrael, they should not go up en masse. So Rashi writes very simply at the top of the page, Lo Yalu Bachoma, Yachad Biyod Chazaka. What does it mean that the Jewish people are not allowed to go up like a wall to Eretz Yisrael? It means that they're not allowed to go up together, okay, that's en masse, Biyod Chazaka, with a strong hand, or i.e. forcibly. The Jewish people are not allowed to go up forcibly to Eretz Yisrael. The implication in Rashi is that if permission is granted the Jewish people to go up to Eretz Yisrael, so then that's no longer a violation of that first of the three oaths, which would fit very, very well with the presentation being made by Meir Simcha. So the question, though, that becomes, where did Rashi get that from? In other words, there's nothing in the Gemara itself, offhand, that would seem to indicate that Bachoma, going up en masse, means going up forcibly. You can go up en masse even with the permission of the nations of the world, right? So how does Rashi know, what prompted Rashi to say that Bachoma, like a wall, implies Biyad Chazaka? I mean, maybe it's the imagery of a wall. You know, you try to run into a wall, it hits you hard, right? But where did Rashi get it from? So the Marsha over here makes an interesting comment. The Marsha points out that history would seem to support Rashi's contention that the first of the three oaths is only prohibiting the Jewish people going up forcibly and not prohibiting them from going up if there's permission granted from the nations of the world. How so? So says the Marsha, let's consider the following. When exactly were these three oaths administered? So they're in Shir HaShirim, right? So it would seem that the three oaths were administered after the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash, the first time that there was galus created in Jewish history after the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash, is when these three oaths went into effect. I mean, maybe you could argue that they went into effect even earlier when Sancheiriv exiled the 10 tribes, but certainly by the time Nebuchadnezzar exiled the Jews of Yehuda and destroyed the first Beis HaMikdash, that's certainly a time when the three oaths went into effect. They didn't go into effect only after the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash. So says the Marsha, so what was the heter for Ezra and Zerubbabel and the entire group of Jews who went up from Bavel to Eretz Yisrael after the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash, when Koresh, the emperor of Persia, issued his green light, his permission to allow the Jews to resettle Eretz Yisrael? What gave all of those Jews the right to resettle Eretz Yisrael? Why weren't they worried about the first of the three Shavuos? So you'll say, well, not so many of them went up. But Chazal criticized the Jews of that time for not going up in greater numbers. The impression you have from Chazal is that they really should have gone up in greater numbers. Why should they have gone up in greater numbers? Why weren't they worried about Shelo Yalu Bachoma, that they shouldn't go up en masse? So says the Marsha, the fact that we never find any indication in Chazal that the Jews going up with Zerubbabel, Ezra, Nehemiah had any concern about Shelo Yalu Bachoma, about this first of the three oaths, seems to indicate, like Rashi, that the issue of violating the oath is only to go up forcibly against the will of the nations of the world. Here, Koresh had given explicit permission to the Jews to be able to go up and resettle Eretz Yisrael. So by definition, that wasn't a violation of the first of the three oaths. So in other words, Rashi derives this idea that Shelo Yalu Bachoma means not going up forcibly from history itself, because history seems to indicate that with permission one is allowed to go up. Okay, we'll come back, we'll try to give another explanation for Rashi, again that I think builds on the Marsha, to see another place where Rashi may have gotten this idea that the only prohibition involved in the three oaths is to go up forcibly. Parenthetically, just while we're talking about the San Remo conference, so there's a cute little news article on the fourth page of the handout entitled Zionist Rejoicing. I got this from the source of all information, i.e. Wikipedia. So you know, if it's on Wikipedia, it must be true, I guess, right? So this is a clipping from a news article from the Times of London on Monday, April 26, 1920. Right after the San Remo conference has taken place, And it describes how the British Mandate for Palestine is welcome. News of the conferment of the Mandate for Palestine in Great Britain has created a great impression on Zionists and Jewish circles. A prominent Zionist has given the following views to a representative of the London Jewish Correspondence Bureau. And they go on to quote this unnamed Zionist leader who talks about how wonderful it is that the San Remo conference has taken place, and now Eretz Yisrael is going to be under the British mandate, with ultimately a Jewish state being created. I just saw like a little thing over here that's just striking. If you look in the last paragraph, it says the event will be celebrated in all Jewish centers with great joy, and the date, April 24th, 1920, will perhaps become a Jewish national holiday. All right, so I'm not aware of any Jewish national holiday on April 24th, but I was curious, so I decided to look up, what was the Hebrew date? April 24th, 1920. So it would work out really well, right, if it was Heyer. It's Vav-Iyar. It's the sixth of Iyar. But the truth is, if you know a little bit about the history of what happened in 1948, the British Mandate was set to end midnight on that Friday, May 15th, midnight May 15th going into May 16th, 1948. The secular parties in Eretz Israel would have declared the State of Israel right there at midnight at the end of the British Mandate, but the religious and traditional elements within the soon-to-be state said, you know, well, we're going to create the state on Shabbos. I mean, it sounds like there should be some kind of Yisrael Rabbanon, you know, making a state on Shabbos. So they pushed up the Declaration of Independence to the afternoon of that Friday, which was Hey Iyar. However, the actual end of the mandate itself was Vav Iyar. So do with that what you may, but it is fascinating, I think, that the decision to hand over Eretz Yisrael to the British was made on the very same day where, just two decades later, essentially, British control would be removed from Eretz Yisrael and handed over to the Jewish people themselves. It seems like something very, very neat about that particular event. Okay, so we outlined Rav Meir Simcha's response to the Gimel Shvuos. I want to take a look at a source which is quoted by the Satmar Rav and seems like a very, very strong source for the Shvuos being binding irrespective of the consent of the nations of the world. This is the last source in the packet. It's from the Maral's Netzach Yisrael. It says Perchav Dalit at the top. And the Maral here in Netzach Yisrael is a work by the Maral of Prague, which talks about the whole idea of Golos and Geulot. It's fascinating reading on many, many levels. If you read it around the Tanesim, you know, where he has a lot of discussion about some of the things that have to do with Tisha B'Av and the various different fast days that we observe through the Jewish year. Very, very fascinating insights of the Maral. The Maral addresses a Medrash which is parallel to the Gemara in Ksubas, where the Medrash there describes that the Ribbono Shel Olam made the Jewish people swear to uphold the Shvuos, these oaths, and he made them swear Bidor Shel Shmad. He made them swear upon a generation that would be subjected to persecution, a generation that would experience martyrdom. We know in general in Halacha, whenever a person swears, so he's supposed to take some kind of religious item and swear using that item, right? We had in Chumash a number of parshios ago that Avram Avinu made Eliezer swear by the Bris Milah that Avram had undergone that was an object of religious value to him. We know that the Mishnayos talk about swearing with a Sefer Torah. The Gemara talks about swear with holding a set of tefillin. Again, lahavdil, it's not so different from what we have in American law, swearing on a Bible or something of that nature. There's an object which one utilizes in order to show that one is serious about the Shvuah. So says the Medrash, the Ribbono Shel Olam made the Jewish people take these oaths and to swear upon a generation that would be subjected to persecution, a generation of martyrdom, a Dor Shel Shmad. So what does that mean? I mean, how do you swear on a generation that's subjected to martyrdom? So if you look in the left-hand column, the Maral, about halfway down the left-hand column, the Od Pirush B'doro Shel Shmad, another way to understand the idea that the Jewish people had to swear based on a generation that would be subjected to persecution, is Rotsa Loma, Af Im Yihiyu Rotsim Lahamis Osam B'inoi Kosha, Lo Yihiyu Yotsim V'lo Yihiyu Mishanin Bozeh. The Jewish people were sworn as follows. It's just the left-hand top. Yeah, the top left-hand column, about halfway down. Va'od pirush b'doro shel shmad. The Jewish people were made to swear as follows. Not only do you have to commit yourselves to these oaths, right, the two oaths which are incumbent upon the Jewish people, but even if the nations of the world come to you and they say, we are going to kill you, we are going to torture you. Im yiyu rotsim lahomis osam beinoi kasha. We are going to subject you to tremendous torments. Right? And the Jewish people, because of that, say, hey, why are we sticking around in the lands of Argolos? We've got to get out of here. We're going to be subjected to all kinds of torments and the like. We've got to go to Eretz Yisrael. Let's make a plan to go bachoma. Let's go make a plan to go en masse to Eretz Yisrael. Nonetheless, lo yihiyu yotzim, the Jewish people are not allowed to leave the Golos even under pain of death and torture. V'lo yihiyu mishanin bozeh, and the Jewish people should not change in any way their adherence to the Shalosh Shvuos. In other words, says the Maharal, the Ribbono Shel Olam not only imposed these three shvuos upon the Jewish people and the nations of the world, he said that even on pain of death and torture, you're not allowed to violate them. The Satmar Rav quotes this Maharal as underscoring the severity of the Shalosh Shvuos, and casts them as a result as almost like a Yehoreg V'Al Ya'avor. They're almost the equivalent on a national level of a mitzvah which one has to give up one's life rather than violate. And clearly from the Satmar Rav's perspective, again, accepting this Medrash is normative, accepting the Maral is normative, again, there are a lot of what one can question whether the Medrash is normative, one can question whether the Maral's interpretation is normative, but being that the Satmar Rav accepts that they are normative, Satmar Rav says, look, even if we knew from the beginning that the Holocaust was coming, or some equivalent torture there, of that ilk, we would not be allowed to establish a state or to even emigrate en masse to Eretz Yisrael to establish ourselves there. And herein we see, again, the tremendous vehemence with which the Satmar Rav, maintained this position. He can trace it in part back to this Maharal. What I think is an issue that has to be raised in this whole discussion, I think maybe just we'll keep the questions to the end. What I think is an issue that has to be raised in this whole discussion is the following chakira, if you will. When learning a sugya in Gemara, oftentimes we'll pose a chakira. Is a concept to be understood in this way, or is it to be understood in that way? I think there's a basic chakira which has to be posed with regard to the Shalosh Shvuos, and I think we'll see that different perspectives on the Shalosh Shvuos come out on one side or the other of this chakira. And this chakira, I think, will help us understand the applicability of the Shalosh Shvuos and the fact that, and the idea that even one who supports the State of Israel today can still see a role for the Shalosh Shvuos in modern-day Israeli policy. I'll explain what I mean by that in a moment. What is the purpose of the Shalosh Shvuos? One school of thought definitely says that the purpose of the Shalosh Shvuos is to maintain the Golos. God has a plan for the Golos. God put the Jewish people into Golos for a reason. Right, one sees this in the writings of Rav Hirsch, not only in Chorev, but throughout his commentary on the Chumash. God had a plan for sending the Jewish people into Galus. God was interested in disseminating the teachings of Torah throughout the world. Again, Rav Hirsch was a great universalist, right? He was a person who believed that there was a message that that Klal Yisrael would share with the rest of humanity. So the Galus plays a constructive, positive purpose. God will choose to end the Galus when he so desires and brings Moshiach, but we ourselves don't have the right or the ability to end the Galus prematurely, and the nature of the Shalosh Shvuos is to keep the Galus intact until such time that God decides to end it. The truth is, the Maharal we just quoted fits in very well with that perspective. The Galus is so important to HaKadosh Baruch Hu that even on pain of death, we're not allowed to end it prematurely because of this role that it plays in God's master plan. Just as an aside, there's a fascinating comment that the Netziv has in his commentary on Chumash, the beginning of Parshas Vayechi. The Netziv, we know historically, Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, the almost last Rosh Yeshiva in Volozhin, his son took over after him for a short period of time. But the Netziv was actually a major supporter of the Chibas Tzion movement, one of the early Zionist movements, and he lent a certain degree of support to that, as well as to the rebuilding of Eretz Yisrael. He has, though, a comment at the beginning of Parshas Vayechi in his Hamek Dover, his commentary on Chumash, where he writes that much of the real activity of Jewish life and the flowering of Jewish life has historically taken place in Galus. And he says it's for that reason. Maise Ova Simon Labonim, Vayechi Yaakov Be'eretz Mitzrayim. Yaakov really lived when he came down to Mitzrayim, says the Netziv. And that sets the tone for Jewish history going forward, that Jewish history oftentimes is the most productive in the Galus. And the Netziv waxes poetic about, you know, all the things that we're here to do in the Galus and how we can accomplish so much in the Galus and the like. I'm not sure how to fit that Netziv in with his perspective on rebuilding Eretz Yisrael, but again, it's an interesting Netziv to take a look at. You know, the great flowering of Jewish life oftentimes is associated with the Galus as opposed to being associated with Eretz Yisrael. In any case, so that's one perspective on the Shalosh Shvuos, that their aim is to maintain the Galus, that the Galus has an independent positive role to play in Jewish history, and far be it from us to end that prematurely until the Ribbono Shel Olam decides that it's over and it's time to bring Moshiach. However, I don't think that that's the only way to understand the purpose of the Shalosh Shvuos, and I think we can even make an argument that if one looks back in the Rishonim, the Maral and Acharon, if we look back in the Rishonim, the earlier commentators, they actually understood the purpose of the Shalosh Shvuos in a very, very different fashion. I want to turn your attention to the page before, which is Igeres Taimon. The Igeres Taimon, the letter to Yemen, was written by the Rambam. Right? The Rambam was consulted by Jewish communities all over the world. And at a certain point, he was consulted by the Jewish community in Yemen. The Jews in Yemen were undergoing tremendous persecution by the local authorities. And as sometimes is the case in those kind of scenarios, the guy popped up in Yemen claiming to be Moshiach. And people are subjected to torment and persecution and the like, somebody waving a sign and saying, "Hi, I'm Mashiach, I'm going to redeem you from all of your difficulties," is a very, very attractive personality. So the Jewish community of Yemen apparently wrote to the Rambam and they asked him, you know, what's the story? Should we follow this guy? Should we not follow this guy? So towards the end of the letter, the Rambam argues very strongly that the Jewish community should not pay attention, should not embrace this individual claiming to be Moshiach. You're going through a tough time, but stick it out, tough it out, you know, it's going to get better. And don't invest in this person who seems to be a false Messiah, because you'll only end up getting yourselves into worse trouble if you attach yourself to a false Moshiach and then it turns out that he's really no good, as will probably be the case, and in making the case not to connect to this false Moshiach, the Rambam writes at the top of the page, Kasher hodia Shlomo olav hashalom beruach hakodesh. Be cognizant of what Shlomo HaMelech said in using Ruach HaKodesh. Sezos ha'uma b'hashkata b'golus, that this nation should try to just be in peace in Golus, should adopt a policy of quietism. Tishtadel la'orer b'zulas ita ha'ro'i, if this nation tries to usher in the Messianic era prematurely, v'yomusu b'avur zeh, rachmana litzlan, people can die as a result of trying to usher in Moshiach prematurely, v'yasigum tzoros, and all kinds of tzoros, all kinds of terrible things will befall the Jewish people if they try to usher in Moshiach prematurely. Hizhir mimenu. So Shlomo HaMelech commanded us that we shouldn't do that. And Shlomo HaMelech told the Jewish people that they would be sworn to not try to usher in Moshiach prematurely, and that's the pasuk in Shir HaShirim, Hishbati Eschem Benos Yushalayim. If you look at note 244, there's a slightly alternative text of this line from the Rambam. Lefi sheyada Shlomo olav hashalom beruach hakodesh, shehauma hazos beorech zman golusa tiftsar lehisnoeya below ito haro'oi. Shlomo HaMelech knew that this nation, in their long golos, would be anxious to kind of get moving, but a little bit prematurely, v'yovdu b'shvil zeh, and they would be lost as a result of trying to prematurely exit the golos, v'yovo aleihem tzoros, and terrible things would befall them, v'yishir mi lasos zeh. Shlomo HaMelech told the people not to do this, v'yishbia ha'uma al derech moshal, and he made the nation swear in the way described in Shir HaShirim. First of all, it's interesting to note that in the Rambam here is clearly referencing the Shalosh Shvuos. The Rambam describes the Shvuos being administered by Shlomo HaMelech as opposed to by the Ribbono Shlomo himself, which is interesting. But what I think is very striking about the Rambam is that the Rambam here is telling us what the purpose of the Shalosh Shvuos ultimately is. The purpose of the Shalosh Shvuos, according to the Rambam, is not to protect the Golos, it's to protect the Jewish people while they are in Golos. Because the Ribbono Shel Olam, or Shlomo HaMelech, realized that there are often times that come about in Jewish history when we are persecuted, and where there seem to be these opportunities to latch on to a messianic figure or the like, to kind of solve all of our problems and get us out of Golos. And yet Shlomo HaMelech knew that acting in that reckless fashion would ultimately endanger the Jewish people. So the purpose of the Shalosh Shvuos is the Ribbono Shel Olam, like a concerned parent, saying to his child, Klal Yisrael, my dear children, don't act recklessly while you're in the Golos. Don't pick up and go to Eretz Yisrael en masse. Don't rebel against the nations of the world, because you know what's going to happen if you try to do that? They'll crush you, and then you'll be in a worse position. Think of the Bnei Ephraim. We just started reading the parshios of the Geula from Mitzrayim. Chazal tells us, it's hinted at the pasuk in Divrei Hayamim, that the Bnei Ephraim decided in Mitzrayim they'd had enough, we want to get out of here. You know, they picked up, they left, and they were slaughtered on the way leaving Mitzrayim, right? Don't be like that. Don't pin your hopes on these fantastic messianic dreams, because you'll get crushed. The purpose of the Shalosh Shvuos is not to protect the Golos, it's to protect Klal Yisrael while in the Golos. And parenthetically, based on that, we can understand the third Shvua, which is administered not to the Jews, but to the nations of the world. You know, don't subjugate the Jewish people more than necessary or excessively. Basically, the Ribbono Shel Olam wants to watch out for our good. He realizes that we need to have a golus for whatever reason, but at the same time, he doesn't want to make our lives overly miserable in the golus. He wants to protect us. So the pact that the Ribbono Shel Olam makes is to have us swear that we're going to not act recklessly, and at the same time to make the nations of the world swear that they'll take care of us. They're not going to overly subject us to persecution while in the galus. This Rambam, I think, is of one piece with the Rashi that we saw back in the Gemara in Ksubas. We asked again, Rashi says, Shlo yalu b'choma means that they're not supposed to go up en masse biyad chazaka with force, forcibly storm Eretz Yisrael and take it over. And we asked, where did Rashi get this idea that it's biyad chazaka? How does Rashi know that the oath only prohibits the Jews from storming Eretz Yisrael forcibly? How do we know that the oath doesn't prevent us from going up without force? The answer is, I think Rashi learned like the Rambam. The purpose of the Gimel Shvuos is to protect Klal Yisrael while we're in Galus. So to do something foolhardy, like all of us are going to pick up and storm Ottoman Palestine and just kind of set ourselves up there, and when they don't want us, and they're trying to prevent us from going, that's perhaps a reckless action which will have negative consequences. It's going to end up hurting us in the end. But if the world at large is telling us, go, create a state, we're giving you permission to do so, so then that's not a reckless act. That's an act of political savvy for us to establish a state to protect ourselves in Eretz Yisrael. Let's go even one step further. If the purpose of the Shalosh Shvuos is to protect ourselves while in Galus, and the collective wisdom of the Jewish people deems that the best way for us to protect our interest as the Jewish people in 2017, 2018, is to establish a state of Israel, right? Rav Soloveitchik Zatzal, when he spoke about the milos of the state of Israel, saw the state of Israel as protecting not only its citizens, but just protecting the state of Jews worldwide. The idea that any Jew could be undergoing persecution anywhere in the world and can come and resettle in the state of Israel and just have a safe haven. If the state of Israel is deemed as being a way of protecting us while in these pre-messianic times, so then arguably the state of Israel is actually a fulfillment of the Shalosh Shvuos. It's not that we're establishing the state of Israel despite the Shalosh Shvuos. We're establishing the state of Israel as a fulfillment of the protection which the Ribbono Shel Olam wants to afford the Jewish people through the Shalosh Shvuos. Again, the Maharal, I think, is not taking that position. The Maharal is taking the position that the purpose of the Shalosh Shvuos is to protect this institution called the Galus and to keep it intact. But I think the Rambam clearly is taking a different position. I think one can argue that Rashi is falling into that category as well. Let's go back to Rav Meir Simcha and look at that letter which we mentioned before. So Rav Meir Simcha says, now that the San Remo conference has declared that we have the right to establish a state in Eretz Yisrael, Sara, the Hebrew language is Sara Pachad Hashvuos. The fear of the oaths has dissipated. We pointed out before, Rav Meir Simcha doesn't say the oaths are no longer in force, but the fear of the oaths is no longer in force. And I think, again, the choice of language of Rav Meir Simcha is very deliberate. It's not that the three oaths disappeared. The three oaths are going to be with us till Mashiach comes. But the purpose of the three oaths is to tell the Jewish people collectively, act wisely, act rationally, don't act rashly. Don't do things which seem to be good and maybe are even defensible, but ultimately are going to cause such an incredible backlash that it's not going to be good for Klal Yisrael, for the Jewish people, whether in Eretz Yisrael or internationally. The three shvuos are still there, says Rav Meir Simcha. It's not that batlu hashvuos, that the shvuos have been nullified, but sara pachad hashvuos. Now that the League of Nations has given its green light to establish a state of Israel, we don't have to be afraid of the three shvuos anymore, because what's now in the best interest of the Jewish people is to establish a state. That's a fulfillment of the idea of the Shvuos. What does this mean in practical terms? So, I don't know, practical terms for us, but just to talk in terms of a state. It's a very fascinating idea, which is mentioned by Rav Ovadia Yosef, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, in an article that he published in the early 1970s. Of course, you know, the early 1970s were just a few years, I think it was 71, so it's before the Yom Kippur War, after the War of 67, right? There was a phrase that was coined I'm blanking right now. The author of Ali Shur, the late Mashgiach and Eretz Yisrael, Revolver. Thank you. So Revolver has a series of shmuzen that he delivered between 67 and 73. He entitled it Ben Shisha LaOsor. Right, we have the phrase Ben Kesel LaOsor that talks about between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. He called it between 6 and 10. Right, the 6-day war and the 10th of Tishrei, Yom HaKippurim, right, the Mechemes Yom HaKippurim. So Ben Shisha LaOsor. So in those days, Ben Shisha LaOsor is, you know, many people here may remember, the Jewish people, the State of Israel, was right off the heady victory of the 6-day war. It was before the tremendous defeats associated with the Mechemes Yom HaKippurim, the 73 war, the Yom Kippur war. And, you know, there was a lot of debate, as, you know, to some extent there's still been debate over the past couple of decades. You know, should we keep these territories that we conquered in 67? Should we return them in exchange for peace? Again, this is all assuming that there was somebody on the other side to talk to, but okay, that's a separate issue. So Rav Ovadia, as is well known, was halachically in favor of returning Yehuda v'Shomron if there was a feeling that there would be peace that could be achieved by Hachzarat Shtachim, by giving back the territories that were conquered. Again, for that reason, the Shas party historically was oftentimes allied with Labor, you know, in terms of their politics, you know, because they did not say that we had to hold on to Yehuda v'Shamron at all costs. So in the course of making an argument for Hachzarat Shtachim, so Rav Ovadia says, you know, to the extent to which the international community wants us to return some territories, right? Territories, some territories, all territories, right? They want us to return some territories. It could be that the Shalosh Shvuos obligate us to return, to give back these territories in order to make peace. And the rabbinic opponents of Rav Ovadia jumped on him. They said, wait a minute. If you're invoking the Shalosh Shvuos, so we don't have a state of Israel, you know? Rav Ovadia, you're a Satmar? Who made you a Satmar all of a sudden, right? Rav Ovadia, you know, certainly was a, you know, tremendous supporter of the state of Israel, served as the Sephardi chief rabbi. What are you invoking the Shalosh Shvuos? The Shalosh Shvuos? Well, why is that a rationale to be machzir shtachim, to give back the territories? So I think in light of what we're saying, whether or not we agree with the specific issue of Hachzarat Shtachim, again, I just want to be very clear, I'm not getting involved in that over here, especially because, as has been increasingly clear over time, there really is nobody to talk to on the other side. So it's all theoretical more than anything else. But how could Rav Ovadia invoke the Shalosh Shvuos and yet be a supporter of the State of Israel? So I think Rav Ovadia may have understood the Shalosh Shvuos much the way we're presenting today. The Shalosh Shvuos doesn't have to be understood as negating any kind of creation of a state till the coming of Mashiach. It doesn't have to be understood as saying galus at all costs until HaKadosh Baruch Hu calls it off. The Shalosh Shvuos can just be a mandate to the Jewish people until Mashiach comes, act in a way which is in our best interest. Rav Ovadia thought, again, here you can disagree, but Rav Ovadia thought that giving back the Shtachim was ultimately in the best security interests of the State of Israel. Hence, the Shalosh Shvuos themselves would be a factor in making that particular decision. So I think what one sees from here, just again, acting on the state level, and again, even for those of us who are not dealing with matters of state, but just trying to figure out how the Jewish community should function in its best fashion in Galus, the message of the Shalosh Shvuos is act responsibly, don't act in a way which is rash, even when we may seem to be right, or we have justice on our side, thinking about what the world at large is going to say is not a position of cowardice, but rather that's just a position of intelligence. In other words, we have to take into account how the world at large is going to react to our decisions, even when we think that those decisions are justified. That's the Shalosh Shavuos, and that's the mandate that we have, Be'ezus Hashem till Mashiach comes. I'm going to formally finish, so anyone who wants to go can go, and then we can take questions afterwards. Just want to thank everybody for coming in. I know it's very, very cold outside, and Be'ezus Hashem, the Torah that we're all learning together should work together with the weather to warm things up, Be'ezus Hashem, over the next couple of days.